Welcome to this ABC Radio National podcast. For more on other enjoyable and informative programs, listen after the end for details. But right now, here's your podcast, which we hope you enjoy.
Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. One of the most surprising things I've discovered recently is that the Hindu and the Jewish celebrations of the New Year occur around the same time. Welcome to the Year of Festivals on the Spirit of Things here on ABC Radio National. The Indian festival of Deepavali or Diwali is also known as the Festival of Lights, but the Reverend Mataji, one of my guests today, says it's more about life and love. This is how the greatest Bengali poet of the 19th century described it.
Rabindranath Tagore, Nobel laureate in literature, describes the essence of Diwali in the following words. The night is black. Kindle the lamp of love with thy life and devotion.
The words of Tagore and the voice of Nandu Mehta, who joins Reverend Mataji later in the program. In the Jewish tradition, several major celebrations occur in this month, beginning with Rosh Hashanah, or the New Year. Rabbi Jeremy Lawrence takes us through them and even blows the ram's horn, or the shofar, for us. Finally, we hear about a unique celebration of Buddhist relics that are on display in Melbourne. So prepare to be intrigued, inspired, and perhaps a little confused. I admit that with some trepidation, I asked Rabbi Jeremy Lawrence of the Great Synagogue in Sydney if he would come on to the Spirit of Things this week, knowing full well he'd be run off his feet with synagogue and communal obligations. But he radiates energy and dedication, so I thought I might be lucky. I went to see him at his home. Rabbi Lawrence, October is a pretty full month for the Jewish community. Rosh Hashanah has just finished, and we're now going into the days of awe, which seems in a way contrary to the notion of a festive time.
Well, we talk about these days as the Yamim Noraim, the days which are full of awe. And in one sense, they are days filled with awe in two senses. One, the majesty and magnificence of God. We stand in awe and reverence and wonder in his presence. And secondarily, the sense of awe meaning solemnity. We are in awe because we contemplate our inadequacies, our lack of worth as against the greater system of perfection. And it's a season of introspection and, we believe, a season of judgment for us. So in one sense, when we talk about this as a period of days of awe, we are looking at ourselves, engaged in self-evaluation, an accounting or audit of the soul, and questioning how do we measure up to divine expectations. But that solemnity has to be tempered with an understanding that this is also a season of God's grace and forgiveness. And in the event that we are able to connect with ourselves correctly and spiritually, and it's important to understand that this is about our relationship with God rather than just our relationship with our fellow man, he will look upon us with the appropriate grace and mercy, and we will be forgiven for those things that we have done. So while we enter into this period with trepidation, and in fact for the month before Rosh Hashanah we blow the shofar as an alarum call, wake up and repent and get yourselves ready, and during this period we say a series of penitential psalms and hymns, when we get to the end of Yom Kippur we do it in a sense of joy and celebration, because we believe that if we have done our part, then God too will do his, and we will be sealed for the year ahead in the book of life, and our souls will have been cleansed. The idea of atonement is at-one-ment. We look at God, and he looks at us at one with each other. So there is awe, there is solemnity, but at the end of it, joy that God is able to redeem us.
Yom Kippur is known for its fast. Is that the only fast that is prescribed in the Bible?
Yom Kippur is the only fast that is directly prescribed in the Chumash, in the five books of Moses. The calendar includes a couple of other fasts. In fact, today, the day that we're recording, the day immediately after Rosh Hashanah, is the fast of Gedalia, commemorating one of the governors of Jerusalem who was a little over-optimistic about the peace process of his day and came to grief. The fast of Esther is one which is mandated in the Megillah of Esther, the Scroll of Esther, as an annual commemoration of her fast going into King Ahasuerus. And there are a number of other commemorative fasts in the year, mostly related to the destruction of the temple. So just 7 weeks before Yom Kippur, we had the fast of Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, which is the other solemn evening till night time, so 25-hour fast in our calendar.
Well, there's no doubt about it that the breaking of the fast is always a joyous time at the end of Yom Kippur, but also the blowing of the shofar. It's really an exhilarating moment when one hears that. What is the symbolism of the shofar? How ancient is it?
According to tradition, the shofar harks back to the binding of Isaac and the time when Abraham, through faith, took his son Isaac to offer him up as a sacrifice, as God had commanded. And the very last minute, God calls out, "Abraham, this is not what I want. Do not lay your hand or do not lay your knife upon your son." And Abraham, determined to make good a sacrifice, sees a ram caught by its horn in the thicket. And according to tradition, the shofar is a cry using the ram's horn of our connection with God. It's used in many different senses. I mentioned before an alarm to repent. It's also, from the Torah, used as a proclamation of God's sovereignty, a trumpet of jubilation. And in fact, during the course of Rosh Hashanah, when we blow 100 blasts on each day, it's traditional to move from different crying noises of the shofar through till the cry of jubilation and joy. And in fact, when we signal the end of the fast on Yom Kippur, even though you haven't eaten for 25 hours, you do try to take a good breath in and blow a decent blast of the shofar to signal that the time of judgment is now over and the time of enjoying the happy verdict that we hope we have successfully been awarded is now at hand.
Well, I've heard you can actually blow Waltzing Matilda on a shofar. Is that allowed? Is it permitted?
It's definitely something that you can do, and it's good to practice a good range of notes on the shofar. It's not one of those things that you really ought to be doing during the shul service on Rosh Hashanah. It was very, very tempting yesterday as there was a Highland piper standing outside the great synagogue just in Hyde Park playing Loch Lomond and various other tunes to go and join him with the ram's horn. But, on the festival itself, I try to restrict it to the appropriate notes. And if you want, I'll give you a couple of those blasts now. So there are a number of different blasts associated with the shofar, associated with different types of calling out and crying. And the tekiah is like a long blast. And then there is the shevarim, a broken note, which is like three wailing sounds. And then the teruah is a sobbing note, blah, 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 blah. These are debated within the Talmud, which exactly is the crying note that is desired. And in true Jewish fashion, because we can't be sure which is the true crying note, we use both of them, the shevarim and the teruah, and given that we want to make sure that each is parenthesized by a tekiah, we blow them in separate combinations to make sure all our bases are covered. I'll play just a straightforward set for you now.
That's Rabbi Jeremy Lawrence blowing his son's ram's horn, or shofar. Apparently it's pretty inferior to the shofar he blew in the synagogue, and he knows horns. He used to play the trumpet. This is the Year of Festivals on the Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National. Well, after Yom Kippur, the slate is wiped clean, as it were. People have made their reparations with those they have wronged or have broken their vows with, and they've also repented to God in the Kol Nidre prayer, the All Vows prayer.
So it seems like it's time to celebrate, and in a few days, lo and behold, Jews are seen out in their backyards in these strange little huts, Jews in sheds, as it were. But these are unusual, aren't they?
Right. There is this idea that as you step out of Yom Kippur, the very first thing you should do before you even tuck into your smoked salmon, fried fish, herring, or scotch, or whatever it is that you break your fast on, the very first thing you should do is go and bang your nail, the first nail, into the sukkah and get it set up to show your continued love of God's mitzvahs. And the sukkah is a very strange phenomenon. True to the strange nature of the festival itself, it's a booth. It's sort of a shed, and God says for 7 days you will dwell in booths. And normally, if we were erecting some kind of divine-mandated object, our intention would be to make something which was entire and complete. But with Sukkot, the idea is that this booth is something which is temporary, and therefore you don't normally just use a room in your house, and you should move yourself into something which is purpose-built for this festival. That's definitely the ideal. And the roof that we have on the sukkah is necessarily defective. The perfect roof for a normal house is one which stops the rain from getting in and isn't too drafty. And when you look up, you feel properly encased. When we have the schach, the special shading covering on a sukkah, it's important that it's mostly shade, but nonetheless it's open to the elements so that water dripping from the sky is able to come in, and if you look up in the heavens, you will see the light of the sky through the covering. So it's exposed. And the roofing itself is necessarily made from materials which have been dedicated exclusively to be used as schach and are naturally found. So the most common kind of covering is either a reed like a bamboo or to have palm fronds just thrown over the top. Essentially, you have a very makeshift and temporary structure into which we're required to move the entirety of our living. So, where it's possible, one will sleep in the sukkah, as well as eat in the sukkah, as well as take your laptop out and have your meetings in the sukkah, as indeed I do during the period of the festival.
Now, the sukkah is decorated in a particular way, though. It's not just bare walls, is it?
Right. In keeping with the mitzvot, we try and do everything in the most beautiful way possible. So, very often you'll have pictures on the inside of the sukkah. Traditionally, over the festival, there are 7 invited guests who are brought in from our biblical forebears, who are invited in, called the ushpizin. Often you'll find pictures of them around the edge of the sukkah. You will find a wall reminding you of Jerusalem. You will find pictures of the 4 species, the lulav, the palm branch, the etrog, the citron, the hadas, which is the myrtle, and the aravot, which is the willow branches, which we wave as part of the festival and one of its other symbols. Traditionally, also, people decorate the roof with fruit and various other things to make it look nice, though it's better not to sit under a pineapple or a pomegranate during the festival.
Jeremy, where do you keep yours? Can we go out and look at it?
Yeah, for sure we can.
Now, is this actually the case of a harvest festival that's been turned into a religious one?
The biblical calendar has a number of different harvest festivals in it. Even though that these instructions were given in the wilderness, it says that the first fruits should be brought into the temple and that the various products of the land should be brought in, as well as the firstborn animals should be brought in to be given to the Kohanim and for sacrifice. So the idea of harvest festivals is definitely out of the Bible, and these do coincide with the harvest festivals. Each of them is given symbolism. So Pesach has the symbolism of the Exodus from Egypt, and we have the Seder, and Sukkot remembers the time in the wilderness. Shavuot remembers the coming down of the Torah at Sinai, Moses going up to receive the Ten Commandments at Sinai. And these coincide with the harvests, but these were times when people would make an annual pilgrimage to Jerusalem, or thrice yearly pilgrimage to Jerusalem as well. So there is a confluence of history and agriculture. I mean, time pre-Israel and exile and being rooted in the land, which are brought together over this season. I think one of the other things that's important to recognize is that while we often consider these as very Jewish festivals, and we're looking at the Jewish festive calendar of the Jewish month of Tishrei, this year coincides almost exactly with October, is that there are some wonderful, thoroughly universalist themes which come out in each of these festivals as well. As we look as God as King of the world, we look as God of all humanity, and the biblical readings on Rosh Hashanah also show God's compassion to Abraham's son Ishmael, son of Abraham with Hagar. On Yom Kippur, we read the story of Jonah and God's compassion for the people of Nineveh, and the idea of that God has compassion on other people, and that the Jewish world's mission is perhaps to teach the unity of God and his expectations of the world, but to encourage them in their own way and in their own form to come to a sin-free existence, because God cares about all his creation, even the plant that he makes to shade Jonah. And if you look at the very end of the book of Jonah, you know, people who don't know their right hand from their left, and also much cattle. God cares about the entirety of the environment. And on Sukkot that we come into now, this is perhaps the most universalist festival of all. This is God in nature, God being celebrated through plants, God being celebrated through it. During Sukkot itself in Israel, which is the beginning of the rainy season, it's the time also when the Jewish world prays for rain and contemplates water as a sacred resource.
Which is perfect, because of course in Australia we're going into the drought season.
Right, so but it always rains on Sukkot, just as you're about to sit down in your Sukkot and in your booth here. In fact, you're on the first night of Sukkot, even when the heavens are opening, you were required to stay there and eat and drink in your Sukkot, at least the beginnings of a meal. Then if you need to take refuge, you can.
Well, that brings me to children, who of course must love this time of year. I mean, for them it's always a great adventure to be out in the backyard, either in a tent and certainly in a sukkah. So I guess your children must be really ready to put
poles.
This together. Oh, those are the poles?
Yeah, so these are... One of the modern conveniences where you can have it is this is an instant sukkah. It's an almost instant sukkah. It's a series of galvanized, I think, aluminium poles which assemble one into the other. They lock into each other, and then you put a nice canvas edging around them. And then I've got here one of
yes, I see some bamboo
things.
Stuff.
These are rolled bamboo mats or reed mats which can go over the top and are dedicated to the schach. And it's absolutely wonderful to be able to set up your sukkah with the kids. And this one came with an instructional DVD how to set it up.
Somebody's making a quid at this.
Yeah, absolutely. When we first got married, Mandy and I were living in Jerusalem. And we were given as our wedding present some money from family members, and I decided that I would use this to buy one of these little portable sukkahs. We were living in an apartment block which had a bit of a garden in it that was shared between everybody else. So I bought one of these sukkahs and assembled the aluminium poles, and we put the canvas around it, and I didn't realize that I'd effectively created a box kite, which I'd tied really tight to itself, but not to the ground. I was never a Boy Scout, and perhaps I should have been. So suddenly, it's just I finish erecting this, and before the schach, the mats had gone on top, which would have weighed it down just a little bit. There's this gust of wind in the middle of Jerusalem, and we're living in an exposed garden area on a slope, and this sukkah picks up and lifts across the garden and is blown into the street, and I am chasing the sukkah down this street in Jerusalem. And you know, God has a great sense of humor. So if you get one of these kit sukkah, anchor it to the ground. And I was thinking that, you know, this is a wonderful
great
way
story
of teaching you about temporary booths.
Indeed it is, the flying sukkah. Yeah. Well, of course, at the end of October, it's Simchat Torah, which also is a great time of celebration for the Jewish people, and I would imagine a wonderful time for children, an important time for them.
Right, so Simchat Torah is definitely one of our happy festivals, and it's one which is thoroughly manufactured. You'll find no reference at all to it within the Torah itself, and it celebrates the completing of one year's cycle of Torah readings and the beginning of another, which we do on the Shabbatot immediately before and after Simchat Torah, and Simchat Torah is sort of the linchpin day. We complete the Torah reading now within a year, though at times in history it's clear that people also used a triennial cycle, and as we get to the end of one cycle and begin anew, it's a time of celebration, and within shuls we take out the Sifrei Torah and we dance with them, traditionally drink a l'chaim as well, and it's an opportunity for the kids to see that shul isn't just about sitting, reading in silence or discussing the shares or whatever it is that people discuss in shuls. It's a time for lively and animated enjoyment.
And at that time, the Torah, as you say, almost becomes a person.
Right, and as you say that, there is a tradition that every individual should write for themselves a Torah. It's one of the readings we just had in shul. It says everybody should write for themselves a Torah. And in one sense, that's fulfilled by writing a Torah, but not all of us can become scribes, or paying a sofer to write a Torah for you, or contributing towards a letter in a Torah. But another almost Kabbalistic way of understanding this idea of writing for yourself a Torah is to turn yourself into a living representation of the Torah, to live erect according to its values and to fulfill the spirituality and humanity that is writ large within the Torah. So in fact, we do treat a Sefer Torah very much like a human being. We treat it with honor and with reverence, and indeed when a Sefer Torah becomes no longer able to be read from because it is defective, the letters have cracked off and it can't be repaired anymore, the tradition is to bury a Sefer Torah in the same way as we bury a human being. So it is the blueprint of creation, we believe, that God has given us to be able to elevate ourselves into spiritual beings, and given that that is the way that our soul becomes fired in a spark of godliness and to aspire towards sociable godly living, it is very much part of our soul, and we relate to the Sefer Torah with the joy of humanity. That's really celebrated at Simchat Torah when we describe the people who read the last passages and first passages of the Torah as the Chatan Torah and the Chatan Bereshit, the grooms, the bridegrooms of the Torah and of creation. These are people who are being wedded to their godly living and the Torah itself.
Rabbi Lawrence, thank you so much for taking this time in your busiest season, no doubt.
It's been my absolute pleasure. I wish everybody a Shana Tova, all the very best for a happy and a healthy season and year ahead.
That's the senior rabbi of the Great Synagogue, Jeremy Lawrence, sending you the first New Year's greeting of the program. I'm Rachel Kahn, and this is The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National. I don't think I'll ever forget that image of a sukkah sailing off down the street in Jerusalem. India's religious festivals are anchored in their scriptures, the Vedas, the Upanishads, and the Puranas, which tell stories of the history of the universe, its many kings, heroes, sages, and demigods. Deepavali, or Diwali, on the 28th of October, is no different. But there is a universalism that goes beyond the literal narrative. Reverend Mataji is one of the best-known exponents of the Vedanta philosophy of Hinduism. She's the president of the Ramakrishna Vedanta Society of New South Wales and South Australia, and I went to its prayer hall in Sydney to speak to her and to the General Secretary, Nandu Mehta.
Well, it's good to be here in the Vedanta Society Hall. How long has this hall been here?
Last 26 years, from 1982 onwards, we are in Sydney.
Well, it's certainly large and has quite a lot of chairs there, so you must have quite a few people coming here. Reverend Mataji, you're the president of the Ramakrishna Vedanta Society, and Vedanta philosophy emphasizes the path of self-realization, a kind of transcendent consciousness that really goes beyond the Hindu religion, as it were. So from a Vedanta perspective, how do you view the Diwali festival?
Vedanta is the philosophical part of Hinduism. It has been misunderstood as being confined only to the philosophy and not the other aspects of Hinduism. Actually, formerly by Vedanta was meant the whole of Hindu religion, that is, dualism, qualified non-dualism, and non-dualism, the three schools of Hindu religion. But later, after the time of Shankaracharya, the great philosopher saint of the 7th century AD, it began to be confined within the philosophical aspect of Hinduism. So Vedanta has got a very, very wide range of view. It deals with life as a whole. It is not dealing with only the transcendental aspect, but life as such. In Hinduism, philosophy, psychology, and religion go together. There is no line of demarcation between the three. And so the daily life of man, his connection with the external world, his mental attitude towards the external world, and his contact with God, all these aspects have to be covered, are covered by Vedanta.
And does the Diwali festival then give one an opportunity to express the Vedanta tradition or the Vedanta philosophy?
Oh yes, we celebrate Diwali festival. Diwali means in Sanskrit, Deepavali. Deepa means light. Deepavali, garland of lights. And it is wrongly termed as a festival of lights. Light represents knowledge. Everything that is good, the revealing power of God. Darkness cannot eradicate light, but light can eradicate darkness. Ignorance cannot remove knowledge, but knowledge removes ignorance. Swami Vivekananda says, when knowledge comes, the mind cannot resist it. When knowledge comes, mind cannot resist it. It just comes in. Darkness cannot come like that. Ignorance cannot come like that. They are just pushed out. So that's the significance behind the festival. Though the ordinary people may not be thinking about it, there are many who do.
How is it compared to other festivals in importance?
Deepavali is one of the very important festivals of Hinduism. The other is Navaratri, which comes just before yesterday it started, the 9 days of, 9 nights of festival. Both are in the name of the Divine Mother of the Universe. And that is the primordial energy viewed as Divine Mother. During this festival, we worship the goddess and we worship the Mother Goddess in the form of Lakshmi. In Hinduism, according to the needs and aspirations and temperament of the worshipper, we look at the Absolute and form a picture of the Absolute according to these aspects of the worshipper. So we have got the primordial divine energy depicted as Saraswati, the goddess of wisdom, Lakshmi, the goddess of prosperity, Kali, the mother goddess representing mother nature. All these aspects come of one, the Absolute.
And in the celebration of Deepavali, are there connections then to the Puranas and to other major figures in Hindu belief?
Yes, there are a few connections with the Puranas. One is, it is celebrating the return of Sri Rama from Sri Lanka after destroying the king of, very powerful king, Ravana of Sri Lanka. And from the south, till he reaches his capital Ayodhya, people welcome him, lighting the lamps all over. Even today, that is done. Another one is, there was a demon king. Demon means powerful tyrant called Narakasura. He had a fad that he wanted to go bodily to heaven. And he had understood that if he could sacrifice 16,000 princely heads, he would go to heaven bodily. So he, a powerful man, went and conquered king after king after king, and got about 16,000 princes in his prison. And all the ladies of these princes he had in his palace. Just before he reached that number, Shri Krishna went and killed him and released these girls and the princes. So this is connected with that also.
Reverend Mataji, her title Mataji simply means mother, and she's a nun and the president of the Ramakrishna Vedanta Society of New South Wales and South Australia. You're with the Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National and online at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. And this is the Year of Festivals, later the largest display of Buddhist relics in Melbourne. Now back to the meaning of Diwali or Deepavali, celebrated this year on the 28th of October. It's also known as the Festival of Lights.
Nandumeta, how big is this festival in the Hindu community here in Australia and in Sydney?
The Hindu community, at least in India, forms the vast majority of India, and Diwali is arguably their most important festival. It is certainly their most well-known internationally. And in this festive environment, the rest of the community pitches in and gets into the spirit of things, if I may draw upon the title of your program. And before you know it, an entire nation is celebrating Diwali. That is in India, and I guess the proportions of the communities are represented in the same fashion in Australia.
So are Australian Hindus enthusiastic in their celebrations?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's interesting to compare how Diwali is celebrated here as compared to India. And if we look at how Diwali is celebrated in India, we firstly would need to preface this remark by making due allowance for the size of India and its 28 states, each of which are bigger than the average country in Europe, and with 22 official languages, each as different from the other as chalk and cheese. So in such a diverse environment, there are bound to be variations within the country, but for all practical purposes of your Australian audience, it could be said that these are only variations on the same theme.
So Nandu, I kind of imagine people lighting lights all over their house or around the house. What are the kinds of things people get up to in Deepavali?
The celebrations extend over 5 days and are unique to each day. On the first day, we propitiate the goddess Lakshmi. This is done by traditionally buying gold and silver ornaments. Traditionally, each house has its own safe, like a safe deposit vault. Instead of going to the bank, you have it in your own house. And this is marked with an auspicious sign called Satya in vermilion. And new books of accounts are opened. So the first day is dedicated to Goddess Lakshmi. The second day is dedicated to Kali Puja. This is the end of the huge celebrations in West Bengal, where she is predominantly propitiated. And the 10-day dance drama in northern India, particularly Delhi, also concludes on this day, depicting the story of Ramayana. The third day is the official Diwali day. In all these days, there is an underlying theme of fireworks and festivities and all that. But on this third day, it is important in Indian tradition to make a good beginning in whatever you do. So if you are trading, the first transaction of the morning is critical. If that goes well, the rest are bound to follow even as day follows night. So with the booming stock market, what happens is that in order to get those first auspicious transactions, and in this awakening giant, which is the 11th largest economy in the world, which closes every day at 4, they crank the wheels open at 6 in the evening and do official trading just for 2 hours so that people can get their first transactions of the year in.
Nandu, I think this is the first time I've ever heard of a religious festival that almost dictates that you do business.
I mean, it is a public holiday and they especially open it up. But this is a celebration of lights, as Mataji says, and it is in fact a celebration of life, and I guess the finances and the economy and the stock market are all part of it. And then if we just go on to the last 2 days, the fourth day is the first day of the Lunar New Year. So that is celebrated with great aplomb. It starts off by people wearing new clothes, new jewelry, and friends and family are visited and greeted with a New Year. It is also a festival called Annakoot, which is literally a mountain of food. And this is a site for the gods. What happens is in temples, 1,001 delicacies are prepared and laid out on silver trays on the altar. And of course, the altar has to be hugely extended in several layers to accommodate these many items. But this is truly a sight for the gods.
Can I just ask you, what happens to it after the festival? Who gets to eat it? Priests or do the people?
No, the priests might get a share, but it is distributed back to the people, following the Indian tradition that only remnants of a sacrifice are to be partaken. So you first make the sacrifice and then partake of the remnants. And on the fifth day is a very interesting day in India. In addition to the traditional Mother's Day, Father's Day, and Valentine's Day, special tribute is paid to the special platonic bond between a brother and sister. It could be a surrogate brother and sister. But this is celebrated on the fifth day. The sister goes to the brother's house and the brother gives assurances of protection and love. So this is an interesting concept perhaps for the West.
Yes, it's got all bases covered, not only personal wealth, but also family ties, very important.
Absolutely. And then if we extend these celebrations to the Hindu community or the Indian community in Australia, the celebrations are a little more measured and subdued. They are not as extended over the 5 days because there is no public holidays. Also, distances are widespread and the community is scattered. Also, fireworks are not available for retail sale. So all this contributes to a more subdued celebration. But the New South Wales Parliament House is lit up on Diwali Day, which is a matter of great pride for the Indian community. Temples such as the Helensburgh Temple and Westmead and the Oban Temple, they conduct special worship. The Bengali community do a big celebration at the Minto Temple on Kali Puja Day. The 1,001 delicacies are offered at the shrine in the Swaminarayan Temple at Rose Hill. And day fairs are held with fireworks, cultural entertainment, food stalls, the burning of the effigy of Ravana, the 10-headed demon. So we have our fair share of festivities in Australia.
Sounds wonderful, but I must ask you, do you remember the first Deepavali festival that you experienced as a child in India?
I'm afraid I have no specific memories of my first Diwali, But the enduring memory I have of the first few Diwalis is being cocooned in love and happiness. And I imagine this richness of love in my childhood Diwalis has very largely shaped me for whatever I am today.
It's a lovely, lovely connection. And it just shows how a spiritual tradition really does shape a personality and an outlook. Reverend Mataji, I must ask you, Nandu has just drawn out a familial experience of Deepavali and some of the values that are brought to the fore there. How do you see the spiritual requirement of the devout Hindu during this festival? What do you think is the important spiritual requirement?
Man is always steeped in worldly miseries and feeling helpless and sees only darkness all around him. Now, Hindu religion or Vedanta has been declaring from time immemorial that man should not go into depression, he should not feel helpless. There is always hope. In one of our ancient Upanishads, there is a very famous, oft-quoted saying, Vidahametam purusham mahantam adityavarnam tamasaparastad tameva viditva adimrutyameti nanyapantha vidyate ayanaya. O children of immortality, I have found the way. I have seen the glorious sun of immortal bliss, of immortal glory. Only by knowing him can you get out of this miserable situation. That hope, that call for revival, waking up, has been the clarion call of Vedanta. Now, through this Deepavali festival, it is reaffirmed. Darkness may be there because Deepavali, the most important day, the third day, is on the Amavasi, that is new moon or no moon day. In that darkness, in India, when we were children, we used to see thousands and thousands and thousands of lamps burning everywhere, even on the boundary walls and leading to the house, on the steps, everywhere lamps, and they just move in the breeze. It's something to see. Only then can we understand. Pitch darkness and all these little wicks, oil lamps burning like that. So that gives you hope. Life, light and learning, we say, go together. Life is to be lived, loved. And it has to be lived with love and also with hope, not in gloom and doom.
And with learning. And I've certainly learned a lot here today with you, Reverend Mataji and Nandu Mehta. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your experience of Deepavali with me. And what would you actually say to me on Deepavali?
We have anglicized this considerably. So we do say Happy Diwali, but on the next day morning, the New Year's morning, we say Sal Mubarak or Naya Sal Mubarak, which means felicitation for the New Year. Thank you for having us, and we wish all your listeners a very happy Diwali.
Thank you for organizing this program, and heartfelt wishes for Deepavali to all the listeners of Australia. Thank you.
That was Reverend Mataji and Nandu Mehta of the Ramakrishna Vedanta Society of New South Wales and South Australia in Sydney, taking us into the world of Deepavali or Diwali, the Hindu festival of lights. Isn't that a wonderful tradition of acknowledging the bond between siblings? When it comes to diversity, Buddhists consist of different traditions, ethnicities, languages, and even texts. But the Buddhists who follow the Tibetan Lama Zopa Rinpoche are bringing all the Buddhists together around some relics which they're planning to install in a huge stupa in Bendigo. The occasion for the festival is Avalokiteshvara Day, commemorating the Bodhisattva of Compassion. The chairman of the Great Stupa of Universal Compassion, Ian Green, is on the line to me from Bendigo.
Altogether, Rachel, there are over 100 different relics on tour down to the Konduk Monastery in Melbourne, and they come from all different Buddhist traditions, and they come from the Buddha's time, and they also come from more recent times. So it's a very wide-ranging collection of Buddhist relics, and altogether it's probably one of the largest collections in the world.
What do relics actually consist of?
Well, in the collection there are three different forms of relics. The first one are things known as sharira. When a body of a holy being is cremated, what's left in the residue and the ashes and so forth quite often are these things that look like pearls or crystals. They're quite remarkable things, but very small. When I'm burnt, it'll just be ashes and bone, but when a holy being is burnt, it's a completely different story after the cremation.
So these are the signs of purity?
They are. They're actually, it's as if all the realizations of that particular holy being are distilled into these sharira.
Have you ever seen them?
I have. We have them there. And not only that, I actually have a video of them. A lot of these are still recently produced, and I have a video of a cremation that happened in Nepal, because, I mean, it does stretch the mind to actually think about why are they there and how does it happen? Do they really happen? But in this video, you see the body of a yogi being put inside a cremation stupa. The fire burns sort of red hot all night, and then the next day, they go through the ashes, and before they do that, the video zooms into the fire, and there, while it's still burning, you see these little round things which are like pearls. Yeah, so that's quite fascinating.
Well, what's the second category of relics?
Well, the second category of relics are body parts of a particular holy being. So, for example, in the collection we have the hair of Guru Rinpoche. So this is considered to be also a holy relic because it has a connection to that particular highly realized being. And then the third category are items which have belonged to that particular holy being. So, for example, we have a fragment of the shoe, one of the shoes of the fifth Dalai Lama, is part of the relic collection as well. And again, because of the connection with the holy being, these are considered to have sort of holy sort of value as well.
Mm. What have you got from the Buddha's time?
From the Buddha's time, we have relics of the Buddha himself, Shakyamuni Buddha. We have several relics which have come from different sources, some from Myanmar or Burma, where there are quite a lot of relics of the Buddha, and others from Thailand. Also from that same era, we have relics of Shariputra and Moggallana.
Shariputra, his loyal servant, loyal disciple.
Indeed.
Are these relics a bit like pieces of the Holy Cross? I mean, are they a bit too prolific to be genuine?
Well, there are a lot of similarities, if you like, between pieces of, or between sort of Catholic relics and Buddhist relics. And one of the similarities is that these relics do multiply. So you can begin with six or eight sharira in a particular relic container, and then you can come back, sometime later and count the number, and that they have multiplied from six or eight to, whatever it is, 10 or 20 even.
So this is because they have supernatural power?
Indeed, that's right. It's one of the features of of relics. But I mean, in a sense, the normal word that relic really isn't an appropriate term. I mean, the original Latin for relic means sort of what's left behind, if you like, whereas in Buddhism, relics really is more accurately defined as like the essence of that particular person as opposed to what's left afterwards.
And what sort of power are relics meant to have, particularly for the Buddhist follower?
I mean, relics are are meant to have, are said to have immense power. Lama Zopa Rinpoche, for example, said that viewing and venerating these holy relics can be the cause for enlightenment. Now, why he says that is that just to see these relics and to experience them, to have it sort of implant something on your mind stream, whether you're aware of it or not, it actually has a very powerful and profound effect. I mean, that's on the profound level. I mean, also, I mean, there are several people who've been to see these relics as they've toured around Asia and around Australia, who've been sort of overcome with some sort of positive imprint. I personally don't see lights or feel anything particularly from these relics, but that's just me, and because I have so much obscuration probably that I'm not sort of able to do it. But other people can see lights emanating from these relics, can actually feel sort of completely overcome and elated by the viewing of the relics as well.
And so will the people coming to see these relics expect not only those experiences but perhaps even miraculous cures as they do in the Catholic tradition?
Not so much miraculous cures in that sense. I don't believe that's really part of the Buddha's tradition of viewing relics. See, the Buddha himself said that his advice to Shariputra was when they said, well, how will we practice? How will we revere you once you're gone? And then he then explained about relics, and that viewing his relics and venerating his relics was just the same as whether he was there himself. So when a Buddhist looks at these relics, it's as if that particular holy being is there in front of you. So while we didn't have the karma to be around in the Buddha's time, we do have the sort of the karma to be here and to actually experience the holy relics.
Ian, this relic tour is going to bring together many Buddhist communities.
Mm.
Is that unusual, or is it traditional to come together around such an incredible display of relics?
It is quite unusual in the world, because normally what happens is that relics of one particular teacher, yogi or lama or whatever, is usually enshrined within one stupa. What's particularly unusual about the great stupa that's being built in Bendigo is that we have relics from all different Buddhist traditions, and they're all being sort of revered with equal respect. And that's why when we travel around, and I mean in Melbourne it will be at Kwong Duk Monastery, which is a Vietnamese temple, even though our tradition is Tibetan, that doesn't really matter much. And in fact we see these relic tours as being a cause for creating harmony and unity amongst Buddhist traditions and also amongst all faiths as well.
And they're expecting thousands of people to visit the relics at the Kwong Duk Temple in Melbourne between the 10th and the 19th of October. Ian Green is the chairman of the Great Stupa of Universal Compassion in Bendigo, Victoria. Well, there you have it. Buddhist, Hindu and Jewish festivals all on the same program. Where else but on The Spirit of Things, which is produced by me and Jeff Wood, with sound engineering this week by Andrei Shabanov. And you can hear the program again online at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings, and while you're there, you can read a transcript in a week's time. Do join me again next week for another adventure into The Spirit of Things. I'm Rachel Kahn.
For the Hindus in Australia, many of whom are first-generation migrants, Diwali for us is a time for searching for our roots, for rediscovering our identity. It is a time to revive and celebrate our culture and tradition and values and social mores. Diwali has a near cathartic effect of producing an emotional experience of feeling purified socially and spiritually.
My name is Bruce.
I've got about 18 sets of seven dwarfs.
It's another crisp, clear night here on my street.
Every street has a story.
He's somewhat of a chatter to people in the neighbourhood.
Venture outside and it sounds like there's a war going on.
It's not too late to tell us a story of your street. And you can be inspired by downloading or streaming Street Stories' My Street Sampler from the Radio National website.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.